Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 21st of February 2016. My name's T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Laura Cressley, Paul in London, Johnny Fox, and Phil from West End Whingers. We're now going to talk about The Master Builder at the Old Vic. This is Henrik Ibsen's play in a new adaptation by David Hare. It stars Ralph Fiennes as Hallvard Solness, who is a self-made architect, master builder, perhaps because he hasn't got any professional qualifications, but he has dominated the unnamed town where he lives. But he is becoming increasingly frightened of one of his young apprentices, Ragnar Brovnik, who is showing an awful lot of promise. And in order to stop Ragnar opening a business for himself as a master builder, he's doing two things. He's basically delaying reviewing and signing off on some of Ragnar's plans, and he's also conducting an affair, we're not sure how deep the affair is, with Ragnar's fiancée in order to keep Ragnar in check. Into this mix comes a young woman called Hilda Wangel, who is somebody he encountered 10 years ago when she was just 13. He was building a church in her town, and he was really excited by this, and in fact so excited by this that he did something which turns out to be rather odd for him. He climbed to the top of the church's steeple and topped it out. He planted a wreath on top of the steeple. This is not something, when Hilda Wangel talks about this, when she comes in and talks to the master builder who she has idolized ever since he sort of bent her backwards and kissed her shortly after doing the topping off, it does appear that this is a rather odd thing for him to have done, because he actually has a terror of heights. And it may be mixed up with this building that he did coming quite soon after the death of his children, or his child, in a fire at the old house where he lived. And it was his first marital home, but it was also the home that he inherited from his father-in-law, who helped set him up in business. And he is now, when we come into the play, he is putting the finishing touches to the rebuild of this old family home. He has again put a tower which will require topping off, and there is no way that he's going to do it except for the presence of young Hilda, who encourages him to be younger. This is a play that's been done a few times before fairly recently. The Almeida did a production of it back in 2011 with Stephen Delane and Gemma Arterton, which was fairly experimental. This particular production is not as experimental as the Almeida's one, which had a lot of dirt on the floor. This is much more, well, classic. You know, the sets are sparse and fairly spare, just really shelving and walls, but nothing too elaborate. They do allow the stage to be fairly bare for most of the time, but it doesn't feel too experimental in that. Well, they're really just letting the acting getting on, and obviously with Ralph Fiennes in this role, it is a role perhaps for the actor who is maybe starting to lose his powers. It was about 12 years ago, there was a big production in the West End which starred Patrick Stewart, and I think it was almost one of the first things he did after spending so many years in America doing Star Trek, amongst other things. And it was one of the big productions he did, that was with Lisa Dillon as Hilda. This production, I was impressed with Ralph Fiennes. He's very much growing on me as an actor. I've seen him in lots of things, but I've not always been, well, you know, it's a thing of being switched on by an actor. You can see that the quality's there, you know, I can always see that the quality is there, but being really beginning to be interested in him as an actor, as in the things he does, and he is really beginning to grow on me, and I'm really enjoying watching things that he does and being pleased to see him. And I thought this was a very impressive piece of work from him. And I was also very impressed by Sarah Snook, who is an Australian actress I don't think I've seen before, but she had an interesting presence. I'm probably over-egging it to say that she did kind of remind me of a very young Glenda Jackson. I don't really want to go quite that far, because obviously, I mean, Glenda Jackson is much too important an actress to me, and it would be rather unfortunate to sort of burden Sarah Snook with that kind of label. But there is that aspect of this sort of She's not the beautiful girl that perhaps Gemma Arterton or Lisa Dillon were when they played it. She's much more sort of athletic and sporty, and there's also a much more of a darkness about her. You know, the idea that it wasn't just the master builder that bent her over and kissed her is always present in her performance, and I was very impressed by that. Other members of the cast include James Dreyfuss as the family friend, the Dr. Herndl, Linda Emond as Aileen Solness, the wife who is still basically mourning her children, and they still have to build in a nursery into any place they have, although there are no children to fill it, and there will never be any children to fill it. We also have Charlie Cameron as Katja Fosley, the young accountant and fiancé of Ragnar Brovnik, who is played by Martin Hudson, and James Lawrenson is also in the cast as Ragnar's father, Knut, who is dying and really wants his son to succeed and perhaps to leave the architectural practice of Halvard Solness's practice. Laura, what did you think of this play?
I agree with a lot of your points, Tim. I think we're very much on the same page on a lot of these elements. Ray Fiennes' performance was fantastic. This was only the second time I've seen him on stage. The first time was a few years ago when he was Prospero in The Tempest at the Haymarket. I don't remember exactly when that was, but I found that performance incredibly underwhelming and came away quite disappointed by his work on stage, but was completely blown out of the water by the way he captured the inner conflict of Halvard in this production of The Master Builder. His energy just really drove through the whole length of it. And it was long. It was a good 3 hours with two intervals. And his character had this pent up energy that from an acting perspective is exhausting to sustain, especially for that length of time. And he was in that state for most of the performance. The only time his character visibly relaxed was when he was around Sarah Snook. He completely changed around her, which was really lovely to see that character contrast. Now, you mentioned the set as well and said it was quite simple. It was definitely simple, but the scale of it I found quite imposing. Yes, it was quite a simplistic set, not overly complicated, but it really filled that stage and dominated the visuals of this piece. The floating wooden disc with the cutout shapes was a really lovely structure, this big, heavy, dark wooden thing that hovered above the stage and moved in each act. Also, the floor-to-ceiling bookcases as well were absolutely beautiful. But now floor-to-ceiling in a house is very different than floor-to-ceiling in the Old Vic. So these things just went up and up and up into the heavens. And the final climactic collapse of the background of these wooden shards that were just completely benign up until the very end, I thought was quite a powerful symbol that was very much in line with the rest of the piece. As for the play itself, I quite liked Hare's version, but it was incredibly wordy. Now, I'll admit, I'm not particularly familiar with this play. I'd never read it or seen it until this production. And even though it was easy to follow, the storyline's quite straightforward and simple. It's very much driven by language. And it is a lot, again, when you get up to about 3 hours long. It's a lot of words. But the actors handle them absolutely brilliantly. They really use the language to drive their characterization and rely on that quite heavily. And again, as you said, it's quite not a conservative production, but it's certainly not, you know, particularly modern or contemporary. This is good old-fashioned realism, but it was executed incredibly well. And the actors' performances are what makes it really come to life and make it really alive. And again, for the length of the play, sustaining that energy and those characters for that long is hard work, particularly the time period that this is set in. And the female characters especially are quite restrained and reserved, with the exception of Snook's character, who is an absolute breath of fresh air. And like you said, she's not very glamorous. She's very earthy. There was something about her that was quite hippie, very refreshing, that the opening image of her walking on stage with her skirt tied up around her knees and a walking stick and looking like she'd been dragged through a hedge compared to the other women in the play was amazing. And the whole energy of the piece changed when she was in it. She's one of the more interesting characters, even though she certainly isn't in it as much as Ralph Fiennes' character. His inner conflict is definitely fascinating to witness, and his collapse is certainly very Shakespearean, almost like King Lear, and in the way he collapses at the end, and his tragic ending is quite remarkable to see. So I really enjoyed this production, but I could understand how some people would be put off by the length and by the wordiness. Again, it's incredibly text driven, but the set goes quite far in countering that and giving such a huge, striking visual to counteract it. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it's one of the highlights of my year so far.
We're now going to talk about Wield by Daniel Foxsmith. This is on at the Edinburgh Theatre and is directed by Brian E. Shanahan with design by Christopher Hone, and is produced in conjunction with Snuffbox Theatre, which I believe Daniel Foxsmith's, he's a co-artistic director of the theatre. It stars David Crellin and Dan Parr, and it seems to be, on the face of it, a rather simple play. A young man comes back to a livery yard somewhere in remote rural England. He's been away for about 8 years, and he needs some work. Things didn't quite go too well last time he was there, and he needs to, well, I suppose, buck his ideas up would be part of it. But he is reluctantly allowed to rejoin the livery stable by Sam, the older man who runs the place, and it does seem to be fairly run down. This livery yard used to be attached to a farm. This farm has been sold off by Sam, and the horses are wholly owned by Sam. They're not owned by other people. So you can see the seeds of decay. And really, what this play is just two actors on stage most of the time. They're just talking, and it's one of those things that where I was slightly surprised when I saw this play, because I was rather fearing this play, because I'd heard a lot of good words about it from various bloggers and people I follow on Twitter saying, oh, you've got to go and see Wield, it is really good. And I had a quick look at it and I thought, oh dear, it's going to be conflict, it's going to be decay, it's all going to be, you know, two people railing on each other and really unpleasant. And I wasn't absolutely sure I wanted to go to see it, but I'm very glad I did, because it's not actually like that. It's a much simpler, much more gentle play. I say this too often, I think, about plays, you know, not being fierce enough. I mean, there's lots of conflict going on here. There is this idea of people coming up and, you know, becoming men becoming men and taking on responsibilities and trying to find a way in the world, and a world that doesn't really want them anymore. And there's an awful lot of that in there, and there is conflict in here, but it is not sort of violent people shouting at each other and swearing at each other. It's really a very interesting relationship, and possibly you can see echoes of a father and son relationship here, and sort of teaching life lessons about how to grow up and how to cope with terrible things happening, or potentially terrible things happening. And I found the play captivating in that way, and very, very impressive, and I can see why people made so much fuss about it. Laura, what did you think of it?
I loved the characters as well, Tim. I thought their relationship was fascinating, and there are a lot of really rich and important themes in there. It was marketed as a play about male platonic intergenerational relationships, and I thought, okay, as a woman going to see this, how much am I going to relate to them? But yes, even though there was very much a focus on their relationship, there were also focuses on other things: failure, life goals changing, dealing with economic struggles, all of these things that are very much of our time. And again, I live in London. I'm very much a city person. This is set in the rural north, and a lot of the things talked about were issues relating to that, the idea of, you know, working on a farm and living in this world that can be quite unforgiving, but is also being taken over by rich city folk who are moving out to the countryside to retire. And there's a really lovely moment at the beginning of the play where the two characters bond over mocking the family that has bought the farmhouse that Sam had sold off. And they were saying, you know, it was quite funny. They're wearing these wellies, but they're completely spotless. There's no mud on them. They've got a really expensive Range Rover. They've put solar panels on the roof and just really taking the mick out of them for being city people and not used to the earthiness and the groundedness and the dirt of the countryside. But one of the issues I had with this play is, even though the characters had that really nice moment at the beginning, there was a real lack of that throughout. There was a lot of talk about the labour on the farm, but these two blokes were quite clean and quite sanitised themselves. There wasn't the real sense of the tiredness and the grit and the dirt and the frustration that comes out of working the land and looking after these big farm animals. I thought it was quite a sanitized view of the countryside, despite what the characters comment on their neighbors. So I thought that was something that it was lacking. Also, as much as I really enjoyed the storyline, and again, similar to the Master Builder, we witness one of the characters' tragic downfalls. And it was a bit rushed for me. This was a much shorter play. It was a one act. And it was very sudden at the end, this character's collapse. All of a sudden, things were just spiraling around him. Whereas up until that point, it was much slower. It was hinted at. And it felt like there were almost some scenes missing or some action missing in there, because it felt like quite a big jump to that dramatic collapse at the end and quite shocking actions on his part. But again, it wasn't a massive issue. It just was a bit jarring to me as I watched it. But I really loved these characters. I thought their relationship was lovely. I thought it was very warm. There was laddish banter, but there was also quite a lot of care and love between these two. Like you said, it was very much a father-son relationship without being a father-son relationship. And both of them had their inner secrets, which are quite satisfyingly revealed towards the end. But again, I just felt it was a bit lacking in a logical progression towards the end. It was ticking along at quite a nice, reasonable pace. And then suddenly it was all a bit rushed, and suddenly everything fell apart and collapsed around that character, Sam. So I think it's something that would the playwright Daniel Foxsmith wish to work on. It wouldn't take too much to tweak that a bit, but I reckon this play could be even an extra 20 to 30 minutes longer and not feel too long, but just make the storyline feel a bit more believable. Also, it would have been nice to see a bit more of that grit and the struggle of farming. This was a very wordy play. Again, they talked a lot, and the relationship was driven by that talk and that banter, but it all felt quite clean to me. And not in terms of content, but in terms of actual dirt. It was very sanitized. But at the same time, I really enjoyed these characters. I really enjoyed the issues that were raised in this piece. And I thought, despite it being quite a masculine play, these issues were incredibly universal. But I would love it if Daniel Foxsmith decided he was going to develop this play a bit further. I don't know if he has plans for that, but it would be great if he could. And I think that could turn a good play into a great play.
We're now going to talk about Hand to God at the Vaudeville Theatre. This is a play by Robert Askins and is directed by the wonderfully named Moritz von Stülpnagel, and has set designed by Beowulf Borrett, while we're at it. It appears to have quite a good cast. We've got J.D., Neil Pearson, Harry Melling, Jemima Rooper, and Kevin Maynes. And it has pedigree from the United States, where I think it played for a while on Broadway or just off Broadway. Paul, can you tell me more about this and what you thought of it?
Thanks, Tim. And I'm glad you pronounced their names, because I'm not going to attempt to pronounce them, because it'll just end in tragedy or comedy for your listeners. I actually really was excited to go and see this piece because it's set in a church puppet theatre, and something which I only just confessed recently to Johnny Fox was that when I was growing up, and I was in that awkward age when you're too old really for Sunday school, but too young to have to sit through a Methodist church service, we did Christian puppet theatre as well. And I think it was only for about 6 to 12 months that I did it, and for some reason I dropped out.
It explains so much. Was it string or glove?
I think it was glove, actually.
It explains even more then.
Yeah, anyway, including why I sound like Fozzie. But anyway, I think this, the whole premise of it, I was quite excited by it. And in it, it's basically Janie Dee is the mother of the piece, and she plays a woman who's set up this Christian puppet theatre in a local church to actually help troubled teens. And one of the troubled teens is her son, who is played by Harry Melling. And what we have in this piece is that the teens aren't that interested in the puppet theatre, but Harry's character, Jason, has managed to probably do the most with his sock puppet, and he's created this puppet called Tyrone. And what happens in this piece is that Tyrone suddenly becomes this character which Jason cannot control and becomes this possessed such puppet, saying the most filthy things and saying the most outrageous things that Jason wouldn't dare say. And that's basically the premise of the show. There's also a subplot that the pastor of the church, played by Neil Pearson, is also trying to lure Marjorie into going out with him because she's a recent widow. But the premise really is about the puppets and the puppets sort of taking over and becoming this evil character. And the comedy from this piece is really about the sock puppet doing the most outrageous things and spreading evil in what is essentially a church hall. Now, that's all very well, but I think what we found in this piece watching it was actually the shocks from it seem to be derived from just saying very crude and vulgar things and also attacking religion in a very broad sense. And while that might have been fine in Broadway, I felt like it was missing something here. And it wasn't to say that the cast were terrific. You know, the cast worked really hard with the material to actually make this piece funny. But actually, I think the story itself just doesn't translate coming across the pond. And interestingly, talking to other people who had seen it in New York, it originally started, I think, off Broadway, then as it got successful, moved to off Broadway and then moved to Broadway. And the general view was that as each iterative step, it seemed to have lost something about its spark. I think it feels overproduced, this piece. The piece actually, it's got this very complicated set, which on press night didn't quite work in one point. Things spin around, things, you know, move it in and out, but it's actually it's a fairly simple setup, really, this whole piece. It's set in a church hall, boy with puppet is possessed, boy goes crazy, and end resolution. And it seems like there's all these subplots, these distractions that actually start to dilute, I think, from probably the strength and the interest, I think, of the piece. That's not to say that, you know, it's a terrific cast, and I think Harry Melling does a terrific job in both mastering this very meek, troubled young boy who also just happens to have a puppet that says the most filthy things. And he gets that distinction between the character he's playing as Jason and the puppet he's using as Tyrone, absolutely perfect and spot on. There's a wonderful scene with Jemima Rooper, who's one of his fellow troubled teens, called Jessica, she plays. And there's a sort of a unspoken interest between the two of them. And she creates this sock puppet that's very sexually provocative. And the two of them in the second act have puppet sex in scene that actually happens. And the two of them, Jason and Jessica, are just completely nonchalant, avoiding eye contact with each other while their sock puppets absolutely go and do the most filthy things. So that's not to say there's these wonderful scenes, comic use of puppets, but the overall message, it just seems so heavy-handed and seems lost on the audience. And I think in the end we were shrugging, going, well, what's all this about? There was an element about the piece, I think, that, you know, works well, but overall I felt it could have been a lot better. John, what did you think?
We went on press night, and press nights are strange, and Americans are even more strange. So at Hand to God, we sat in a part of the stalls surrounded by a very distinct group of people, sort of younger, semi-professional American men fawning, I mean, literally salivating and fawning over older Upper East Side women, you know, matrons who's that kind of very New York combination of spun sugar hair and Harry Winston diamond rocks on their fingers that often means they're the money behind the show. They'd obviously seen it in the States, even whether or not they were investors or they were just, you know, kind of friends and family of the production team. They knew this show and they knew when to laugh and where to clap. So that if you haven't really been paying close attention, you might not have spotted the Brits in the audience looking blankly at each other to see if we collectively missed some point. Because we saw Phil from West End Windows, who we'll hear from in a minute, in the interval, and we were all just kind of slack-jawed at, why is this funny? What are they laughing at? Because it just isn't strong or shocking enough. And, you know, it's my contention that there's an enormous gulf of understanding across the Atlantic between what is satirical or witty or clever and what isn't. And my prime example is Book of Mormon, which is devastatingly shocking if you're the kind of American who believes that, you know, the church has an important place in society. But if you're a Brit, it washes over you and you just go, you know, how many times have they said the C word? And I'm much less impressed by Book of Mormon than a lot of reviewers were. So to American audiences, I can see that, you know, taking a stick to the US Bible Belt and projecting it as this inbred, rather stupid community would make sense and might be a little bit alarming. And American theatre doesn't tend to use profanities nearly as much as we do. But we don't really have this concept of blasphemy, I think is the word. And we don't, or if we have it, we don't mind it in the same way that Americans will get on their dignity about it. So it doesn't have the shock value. What does it then have? It has a terrific cast, as Paul says. There is nothing wrong with anybody in this piece, and they are all good and faithful replications of the characterizations that were given in the States. Jenny D possibly does even more with the character of Marjorie than humanly possible. And her interactions both with her own son, Harry Melling, and with Kevin, particularly with Kevin Maynes, who is a sort of urgent young lover, are great fun. And I think the scenes where she and Kevin Maynes are kind of throwing each other about stage trying to have angry, violent sex are terrific. There were a couple of moments where she nearly caught herself on sharp edges of stage furniture, but as they get used to the geography of the stage, I'm sure it will get very much better. Harry Melling, I thought, was an astonishing revelation, really. For those who don't know, he is Harry Potter's fat muggle cousin in all the films. He's Dudley, child of Richard Griffiths and Fiona Shaw. And he has thrown off all the puppy fat and all the peevishness of Harry's cousin. And he seems to have emerged as a really imaginative actor. And his ability to, I think as Paul mentioned, to detach his character acting from the puppetry and to do two things at once. So, you know, to be nervous and shy and avoiding eye contact with Jemima Rupert whilst their puppets are hammering away at each other is very clever. But also there's a scene where his own puppet beats him up, and the expertise is tremendous. And you know, I don't think he is a trained puppeteer. I don't think that's the career path he's chosen. He is just an actor, but it's very, very good. So there's a lot to like in it. And at first, I was a little bit shocked when, within an hour of the curtain coming down, Mark Shenton delivered such a swift and punitive first review with one star, which, you know, really must have dampened the after-show party. But I think it's because it isn't good enough. And as I said, it's because of this gulf of understanding between American humour and British humour. They don't translate. One of the other things that made me think about this gulf is that there's a sweetly amusing scene between Jemima Rupert and Harry Melling on, they're sitting on swings, and Melling's shy character just riffs a little snatch of the very, very antique "Who's on first?" sketch, you know, who's on first, he's on second, you know, I don't know who's on third. It comes from an Abbott and Costello film in the 1950s, and it's been used again and again and again in different formats in comedy across the years. Now, as a bizarre example of what Americans find appropriate versus what happens here, the Abbott and Costello estate sued the producers of Hand to God for misappropriation of their material. Now, they didn't win, but it was a big court case, and producers of Hand to God had to demonstrate that they hadn't simply been too lazy to write original comedy, and they were being, you know, sort of gently referential rather than thieving of it. But that anyone should take that to a court and, you know, hire expensive lawyers on both sides to prosecute and defend it seems bizarre, particularly for a joke that has been dead for more than 50 years. Clearly, nobody involved has ever seen a single British parental pantomime because it's in every one of them. So that's the issue for me, really, that if you want to make an audience from a nation weaned on spitting image sit up and take notice, you have to do something really much more thoroughly outrageous. And, you know, on the way back from the show, Paul and I were trying to imagine what it would be, what kind of British national institution or sacred cow you would have to desecrate on stage in order for it to be shocking. And we eventually decided the only thing they could do would be to bum Mary Berry with a flaming crucifix.
Or you could actually have translated everything into an NHS treatment centre.
Yes,
that could be another alternate. But I suspect that's a new...
There's a sequel in the making.
Yeah, that's another puppet play altogether. As I thought about this show more during the course of the week, I thought, no, there's a lot of terrific elements about it. The acting, the puppetry was spot on. It was the central message, though, that really diluted the enjoyment of this piece. And I can understand why some reviewers actually gave it one or no stars for that reason, because it was just so disappointing in that respect, because it could have been so much better. But having said that, anyway, you can understand why people like it less, and it's been reviewed a lot less favorably, because it's just not shocking in a city that, you know, where our city buses ran advertising saying there probably isn't a God not so long ago.
So, Phil, what did you think about Hand to God?
I actually hated it, to be perfectly blunt. Having said that, I'll say some of the good things about it. I sort of do agree that the performances in it were pretty good. Janie D, really like Janie D in almost anything she does. And I thought when she, after having seen Mrs. Henderson, the presenter, the week before, I thought, oh, she's had a narrow escape there. But actually, not so sure, because actually, I really disliked this. It's not that she's not good in it. The problem is the script. Again, Harry Melling as the boy who plays Jason, who has this sock puppet called Tyrone, who sort of finds a voice of his own, and actually it's kind of like a demonic possession, or is he schizophrenic? I don't know. I mean, he's a troubled sort of teenager playing the son of Janie D, and he did it absolutely fantastically. I mean, he manipulates the puppet very well, and he does the scenes very well, but again, he has this sort of one solo scene in his bedroom, and he was doing it brilliant, but it just wasn't making me laugh, which it was meant to, and people were rolling around with laughter the night I saw it, but that was the opening night, so you would kind of expect that. The Americans were in. I felt the whole show was really, really desperate to shock in a similar way, in a way, to Book of Mormon. But with Book of Mormon, it's actually funny. I don't think it's going to shock anybody here. It didn't shock me. The sex scene, which people seem to refer to, I actually, by then, I was kind of just sinking in my seat and just finding it not very funny. I thought it was well done, the puppet sex scene with Jemima Rupert, who is the sort of the she's a bit like Velma from Scooby-Doo. I thought she was very good in it, but it just didn't work. It didn't make me laugh, and it was meant to make me laugh, and it was meant to shock me. It didn't do either of those things. It was quite puerile as well, actually. And the whole religious thing, it didn't really feel... if it had been funny, I think perhaps it would have had a bit of an attack, but it actually seemed like a rather lame attack on it. Book of Mormon actually attacks religion, but actually kind of takes it on side at the same time. It's kind of slightly warmer. Not that I'm saying I wanted warmth from this play, but I just kind of felt something a bit more subversive. How about you, Tim?
It was a very American take, and they're clearly very nervous, as other people have said, the whole religious aspect and really not wanting to offend. I think they're Lutherans, so it's Protestant and a very nice kind of religion, and not at all nasty. I mean, it's not like they're Southern Baptists or Roman Catholics. It's a very mild target, and it's a very mild form of Christianity, so it's not... easy to really make fun of it, and I don't think they're trying to make fun of it, but he's trying to hammer home points. The puppet is trying to, you know, make points about religion, and yeah, we're past that sort of thing in this country. I think perhaps they're not quite so in America, and if you had something that really satirized the church from a British angle, it would be so shocking in America that they probably wouldn't watch it, and they probably wouldn't find it funny, but we would probably find it extremely scabrous. But again, yeah, Harry Melling, if you believe in inheritance, he has good acting genes. His grandfather is Patrick Troughton, his uncles are David and Michael Troughton, so he's long been a favourite actor of mine since he sort of lost all the weight and started doing very interesting stuff on stage. He did an adaptation of Christopher Isherwood, I Am a Camera. He did When Did You Last See Your Mother at the Trafalgar Studios, and he was very good in that. And also he did his own play last year at the Arcola Theatre. And he is a major talent and a major force. It was so good to see him doing something really well, even if the script was really not up to it. I mean, it would have been so much better with something more vicious and more scabrous and nastier in many ways, and where the humour is much blacker and much more horrible. But this is, it's kind of, everybody's nice. It's a sort of wanting to get up ahead of steam about some really nasty religion, and you end up with something nice and cuddly, mild form of Protestantism. It's like trying to attack an Anglican vicar. There's no fight in the play, and there really ought to be, I think.
I do agree with you, actually. If there's one reason to see the play, it's Harry Melling. He does it really well. I just think it's a shame about the material that they have to work with, because perhaps, as you say, a British version of something like this perhaps would have more bite to it. But actually, I find there's quite often with things that hits in America, with particularly plays, comedies, that when they come over here, that it doesn't really work. And I don't quite know why that is. Because they're, you know, Americans have got brilliant comedy. I mean, let's, you know, look at the best sitcoms. The standard of the very best stuff is just spectacular. Felt like that's what I was sort of hoping for here, but anyway.
Yeah, it is perhaps that in America, you write an episode of a sitcom by yourself, then it gets thrown into the writer's room, and they spend a week tuning it up, making the jokes funnier, and right up until recording. You're getting tune-ups, and there's very few people, when you write a play, you're not going to be doing that. You're not going to suddenly say, okay, let's workshop this script until it's so tight, so perfect, so wonderful. I mean, you've got the rehearsal time to do that, but again, you've got a rehearsal time with where the writer is present, and people might not feel that they can really riff on the work and really go off on that. The sitcom has that collaborative, has that polishing, that fine-tuning in American sitcoms, which you don't get when you're writing a play, because a play is far too much of an individualistic thing.
Mind you, they did. I mean, presumably it had been changed, because it was, I think it was an off-Broadway hit, and then was sort of around for a while and then moved to Broadway. So I would imagine there's probably been some tweaking for our British sensibility, but not tweaked enough, perhaps.
We're now going to talk about Mrs. Henderson Presents. This is a musical based on a film written by Martin Sherman. It's on at the Noel Coward Theatre. It's been directed by Terry Johnson, who also writes the book. Lyrics are by Don Black, and with music by George Fenton and Simon Chamberlain. It stars people like Tracy Bennett, got Emma Williams here, Robert Hans, an old Propeller favourite, and Ian Bartholomew. The film was, I think, quite reasonably popular when it came out. It starred Judi Dench and Bob Hoskins as sort of the two protagonists in this, Vivian Van Damme and Laura Henderson. And it went over quite well. The musical had a run in Bath earlier last year, and I think was rather well received. I've seen one or two five-star mentions of it. I'm not sure that we're getting quite that here. Phil, tell me more about what you thought of it.
Well, given that the notices, as you mentioned, from Bath last year, and the casting of Tracy Bennett, who I'm very keen on, and the sort of the general kind of musical-y kind of vibe to it, this sounded like a show that would be really up my street. Even though, actually, I kind of found the film quite underwhelming, and it was probably quite popular, and Judi Dench got an Oscar nomination for it, but that was kind of the period where every film she made she got an Oscar nomination for, and I don't think she probably would now for this. You sort of seem to be in popularity with Oscar noms anyway. I had a lot of problems with this. One, it's comedy I did not find funny. The story, which is obviously about the setting up of the Bournemouth Theatre with the sort of the new tableaux, which is a way they got round the censorship of the period through the Lord Chamberlain by having non-moving tableaux, a bit like a painting from the National Gallery and there's a scene set in a gallery in the show. I found that a lot of it is meant to be funny. There's sort of in between scenes, there's Jamie Foreman playing a sort of Max Miller cheeky chappy kind of stand up and who's sort of part narrator, part sort of comedy turn. And it was just dismally unfunny. I mean, I did see the first preview, so I think, you know, probably some of it would have got a lot better. But for most of the rest of the cast had been at Bath in lead roles, and it's not about the cast so much, anyway, it's about the show itself. I found it really rather flat, unfunny, quite dull. There's not a huge amount of plot, really. Its second act sort of takes a slightly darker turn during the war when the windmill stays open, famously, with the "We Never Close" slogan. And I just didn't really care about it. I also found us had a slight problem with the nudity in the fact that, I mean, obviously you can't do the story, tell the story without having the nudity. But there is a kind of a slightly kind of, there's women getting their tits out and there's, you know, that's kind of going to drag the punters in. And although it is tasteful and they do kind of quite cleverly sort of redress that by getting the men to take their clothes off too, it's, I don't know, I still feel a bit uneasy about it. I didn't find the music particularly memorable. Well, actually, I didn't find it memorable at all. It's very sort of pastiche of stuff of the period. There's quite a clever, in terms of sound, Andrew's Sisters style song. Although, again, the night we went, you couldn't hear the lyrics during the ensemble numbers. I didn't find the lyrics, Don Black's lyrics, particularly interesting. They had the odd moment in them, but that was kind of few and far between. I just felt a feeling of nothingness about this show. It actually began to sort of irritate me as we go on, because people were laughing slightly at the sort of the comedy bits, but not a huge amount. And that may have, maybe it hadn't settled into the theatre. But, you know, given how well received it was in Bath, I was kind of quite shocked. And actually, it's been very well received here on the whole, apart from The Standard, which I think was a 2-star review. I felt it just underwhelmed by it. I will say, though, that I thought Emma Williams, who's sort of the tea girl who bravely becomes one of the windmill girls, actually really was very good in terms of both her singing, her acting. She's quite touching. And for me, she was kind of the knockout turn in this.
John, what did you think about Mrs. Henderson Presents?
Well, I'm very much of the same mind as Phil, except I thought Tracy Bennett looked exactly like Dr. Evadne Hinge rather than the cross between Mrs. Merton and Maureen Lipman. And it really was, vocally as well, she sounded like Evadne. I think there's a place in the British theatre for shows like Mrs. Henderson Presents. It's called The Provinces. When I went to see it, it felt like pulling on a warm and comfortable old coat, really. It's so wallowy in pastiche and nostalgia and patriotism from the wartime that, you know, I think it's no coincidence that it's coming out at about the same time as the movie of Dad's Army. It's going to appeal to the same audience. I think it might have a hard time in the West End because I don't think it's got sufficient edge to be a really successful play in as big a theatre as an Old Coward. I found the music pretty forgettable. I always try on the way home to see which songs I can remember. And the only thing I could do, and it stayed with me like an earworm, was "Biddly Diddly Dee, Biddly Diddly Dee, Everybody Loves the Windmill." And that just came round again and again and again and again. And I know Phil, and in his Winters review, mentioned specific songs that had a little bit of quality about them, but I couldn't retain them long enough to get home. You know, I do think it's very difficult to do nostalgia, wartime reverie and patriotism without resorting to pastiche. And I felt that Mrs. Henderson suffered in comparison to shows that had gone down that same route. And the things that it most reminded me of were Betty Blue Eyes. And then I thought, well, you know, maybe it isn't possible to get a contemporary successful musical out of the wartime, because if Betty Blue Eyes can't do it, if Stiles and Drew can't do it, nobody can. And then the other thing that it really, really reminded me of, particularly when they went into the production numbers and the tap routines, was Acorn Antiques the musical. That's not necessarily a criticism, because I thought Acorn Antiques was very good, but it is very, very pastiche, and I felt that what Mrs. Henderson suffered from is a complete lack of originality in the treatment. Obviously, you can't be original in the story because the story exists and is dramatic and interesting. And if they hadn't massaged and sanitized it to make it into a musical, I think it would have been a much better stage play. And somebody said to me recently, why does everything have to be a musical? And it's a good question. This is a little bit like Calendar Girls, you know, sometimes things are best left in the original form, and I think this would have made a much better stage play than it did a big.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.
Song and dance show.